The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they are
start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. Let's do the announcements and get on to talking with Dr. Seedhouse. For those of you who would like to call us and talk to Eric Seedhouse about his book, which we're going to be discussing, SpaceX Making Commercial Spaceflight a Reality, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Just be patient. Let the phone ring. We'll answer it and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. If applicable, I'll hold you over the break, and I also do answer the phone during the break. For those of you without access to a phone or too shy to use it, the email address is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then please do check out our website, that is our website address, thespaceshow.com. And you will find on that website the comprehensive newsletter. It gets uploaded after the Sunday show. So it has all of the programs for the week, the full guest bios, and it's also the only place we have a future events section to tell you what's in store for the Space Show over the next couple of weeks. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or easily download the programs. There is a Space Show store near the top. It says Gear. Please do check it out. There is a tool next to the social media buttons called Guest Search. And here you can do a global search like you would in Word or Excel or a PDF document for your favorite space word, term, or person, or event. You can find out when we did space shows covering that topic or with that person. And then you can pull all of those programs up by date on our own Space Show program search engine off of our website. There's also a Support the Space Show button there. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. We thank all of you who do support us. Your support does make possible the Space Show, our webinars, and all of our content free of charge. So remember, for those of you paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a tax deduction. For those of you doing the same in California, you also get a California deduction. Also do remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, but we do permit everyone to download these programs and to share them and to pass them around to people you think might be interested in learning more about space. Also, we're podcasting. We do thank Andrew over at gigadial.net. He does all that for us. And you can find the RSS URL on our website. Both of our newsletters and our podcast are in lots of places around the net, including Microsoft Zune and, of course, iTunes, plus other places as well. And then finally, do remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security, and you can get much more information about them by going to their own website, www.swfound.org. They sponsor our webinar series. Our next one, August 18th, is about NEOs, and more information will follow as we get closer to that program. Our guest today is a Space Show favorite, and I was just checking. This is your 11th book. Is that correct, Eric?
I'm the 12th.
The 12th. His bio is all over the website. I really probably don't need to even introduce him. But Dr. Seedhouse has his PhD in space medicine, and he is one of the most prolific writers I've ever had the opportunity and the good fortune to know as a friend and to talk to on the space show. His latest book is SpaceX, Making Commercial Spaceflight a Reality. Springer Praxis publishes this book and all of his others, and he's been on the show about most, if not all, of his other space books, starting back with Tourist in Space, A Practical Guide, several years ago. He's a special forces guy, a paratrooper, astronauts for hire. You can read about him on our website, and you can Google him and find out even more. And, of course, if you buy his books, he has a full page and a half of letting you know who he is, what he does, why he does it, and what his expertise is in those specific areas. Eric, welcome back to the show. And SpaceX, they're certainly on everybody's mind in terms of commercial space, new space, changing the way our space program has been working into something that can be more economic and more productive for everyone involved. How are you?
All right, thanks for having me back on the show.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, that was the reason for the book. I mean, obviously, when you try and write, when you come up with an idea for a book, you obviously want to try and make it as commercial as possible, because you want as many people to buy it as possible. And like you said, SpaceX, it's in almost every issue of Aviation Week and Space Technology. It's every week almost they do something new. They hit the headlines. They're in the media. And they're the most successful commercial startup in the world. And I think in a few years, 10, 15 years from now, people will look back and they'll talk about Elon Musk in the same way they talked about Wernher von Braun being responsible for the success of the Apollo missions, because what Elon Musk has done is nothing short of recalibrating manned spaceflight.
Absolutely. But I was surprised when I read the book and went through it. You've got much more than SpaceX in this book. I mean, you've got the others that are participating in commercial space, the suborbital companies. I mean, it really is a comprehensive look at commercial space flight. It's not 100% and only 100% SpaceX, correct?
No, because what I wanted to do is, it's a popular science book, and I'll try and bring that to the level of the person in the street. So a lot of people, they may have heard of SpaceX, but they have no reference point with regard to the, you know, what commercial spaceflight is. So I try and provide that information there as background information, so people understand, you know, what the Space Act agreements are, what the commercial orbital transportation services is, what the commercial resupply services are, because without that background, you don't understand the environment in which SpaceX operates. And also, people aren't really familiar with the complexity of actually developing a rocket engine. So I put that information in there as well. And then also I look at the various development challenges of the Dragon and Falcon 1 and Falcon 9. And then also I try and put that into context with the other competitors, because it's not just SpaceX, although SpaceX is in the lead. There are other companies such as Boeing and Sierra Nevada Corporation, ATK and Orbital, Blue Origin. They're all in the race to try and deliver astronauts to the International Space Station. So I try and put that in there to provide a background and also a reference point. I just want to emphasize that I did approach SpaceX, and I did want to try and get collaboration with them, but they said they didn't have enough time. I'm not sure whether that's code for something. So I did get some collaboration from Hannah Post in media, so I'm grateful to her for use of some of the images. So this book is really just an account of the first 10 years. In fact, that was the original subtitle, was SpaceX, the first 10 years, but my publishers decided to change it.
Did you send a copy to SpaceX? Have you had any feedback from anyone high up in the system?
Not yet. I thought I might wait for some more reviews to be posted on Amazon. I thought maybe a SpaceX employee might post one. But they are very, very difficult to interview. I have a colleague who works for SpaceX, and I wanted to give a snapshot of a SpaceX employee, of what they do and, you know, where they work and what it's like to work for SpaceX. And he said he was fine with it, but he couldn't get permission from his boss.
You know, when SpaceX started out years ago, and they did not tightly control PR, and it was easy for me to get people to talk on the radio on the space show, as well as Elon and Gwen. They had a lot more time and a lot more availability way back when, and the space show doesn't do sabotage interviews, but I know a lot of people do. We allow people, even if I think they're whack jobs, to speak their mind and to be treated with respect. And you know, I'll ask hard questions, but I'm not there to destroy anybody by any means. But they did find, through the school of hard knocks, I guess, that you do have to have a tight lid on press and who speaks for the company, because there are people out there that will twist and distort and alter and sabotage every word you say, every context, every meaning, because they have an agenda that doesn't support your agenda. And while it makes it much harder to get key people from SpaceX on the space show, even at conferences, I fully understand and support their tight control of media and how they work it. Because there are people out there that would absolutely, you know, give their eye teeth to do them in, or to distort something, or to mislead. And they have to be really careful. That's just the world we live in. So I understand why they do it. I understand why Blue Origin keeps a lid on their PR, you know, and are very, very tight about it, too. I actually think the companies that produce ad nauseum press and media reports and stuff like that don't really do themselves a service, because it's too easy to distort and twist, and there are too many people out there now that do self-publishing on blogs and this and that and their websites. You have no idea what could be said. So I support them in that, but it does make life a lot harder. And I fully understand it, though. But I think they're a great company, and I think the I don't like saying this, but I think the future of the commercial space industry and a lot of the space industry is on their shoulders, and I would like to see more diversity. I don't like to see all the eggs in one basket, but I think SpaceX has become such a key, important, and fundamental player that sort of all the eggs in one basket has defaulted to them automatically, and I'm sure that puts a lot of pressure on them as well. I know they are aware that is out there.
Well, I think it'll be, if Sierra Nevada Corporation and Boeing don't catch up, then there'll be a lot of pressure on SpaceX to fly the manifest.
Even more pressure, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, they have 30 launches, more than 30 launches on the manifest. And if Boeing don't come along or Sierra Nevada don't come along, then there's going to be more and more flights booked. And as you said, yeah, there'll be more pressure on SpaceX to fly those.
You know, I've been fortunate to visit SpaceX two or three times and see their manufacturing Dragon, you know, the whole thing. And it is really impressive, and the employees are amazing. And, you know, I really believe it is a successful company and operation. But honestly, I've got space show listeners who think the company's a failure. And I'm sure you probably ran across some of that in your book, did you, when you were researching your book, that not everyone shares the view of the success and the prominent role this company is now and will play moving us forward into space.
Yeah, I did run into some of that, but I didn't really put that in. I didn't put much of that in the book. In fact, there's hardly any of that in the book, because, like I said, I'm a big fan of SpaceX and what they've done, and I wanted to make this as upbeat as possible. And in fact, one of the few criticisms of the book from the reviewers was that it was too upbeat. It was too positive. And they said it was more like almost like reading an advertising manual for SpaceX.
Cheerleading book is I guess what they're talking about, right?
Yeah. So, but I make no apologies for that, because, like I said, SpaceX have done the impossible to a certain extent. They've done what only governments have previously achieved. So, and they've done it in such a short space of time as well. And you know, where they've come from and where they're going. It's nothing short of a paradigm change in man's space flight.
You do have a section toward the end of the book, and You talk about what happens if SpaceX has a bad day. So what do you think happens if SpaceX has a bad hair day?
Well, they've had a bad day already. They've had a few bad days, so I think they're going to be hopefully they're in for a good clear run, because don't forget they had a lot of failures to begin with the
Falcon 1.
With the Falcon 1, yes. I mean, they only succeeded on the fourth launch. But yet, that may be as a result of the manifest. If they get overloaded, if the manifest gets overloaded and there's too much pressure to launch, then we do know in the space business that things go wrong. It's a highly complex industry, and I think it will just. It depends whether it's an unmanned launch or whether it's a manned launch. I think obviously, if it's a manned launch that goes wrong, then there could be a stumbling block there.
Do you, what did you, so you were not able to interview any SpaceX employees or anyone for the book, is that correct?
No. Even a colleague who works there, who I've known for quite a while, they wouldn't allow me to even feature him. They wouldn't even allow me to put a photo of him in the book.
Interesting. So, in terms of this effort to see the commercial industry, COTS and commercial crew flourish and really take off, does it, in your opinion, depend on SpaceX and the SpaceX timetables? Or is, now that Orbital's had, their inaugural test flight, how big a role is that? What about Sierra Nevada coming online? Can the others influence the direction we're going and the timing and the importance of how we're doing things in commercial space, or does it, in your opinion, really fall on the shoulders of SpaceX?
Well, not so much falls on the shoulders of SpaceX. I think it falls on the shoulders of NASA, because don't forget, NASA's funded 80-90% of the cost of development across the commercial companies, which are Blue Origin, Boeing, Sierra Nevada, SpaceX. And so there's a limit to how much each of those companies will fund themselves. I mean, Blue Origin has gone off the radar, and they're now self-funded. But I do know that Boeing is a juggernaut in the aerospace industry, and they said if they don't get the money coming from NASA, they'll be unable to continue the development of their vehicle. So right now we've got SpaceX. They're working through a 12-flight, $1.6 billion contract with NASA for a resupply service. And then I think NASA's spending another $1.1 billion to help Boeing, Sierra Nevada, and SpaceX develop the human-rated vehicle. So I think that's where the crunch point is going to be, is when that is man-rated. So I think SpaceX obviously is in the lead with Dragon, and I think Boeing is probably next in line with a CST-100, and then you've got Sierra Nevada. So, but again, it depends on the funds, and that's really down to NASA. People don't really understand when we talk about commercial spaceflight, they think it's all commercially funded from the companies themselves. But no, that's the big figure. NASA funded 80-90% of the cost of development across all those companies.
So, in your opinion, is sequestration in our economic crisis, I'm going to call it a crisis, although the others say that these are all phony crises, but does this have the potential to really derail SpaceX and commercial space, in your view?
Well, I think it depends on the return on investment expectations. So you have all these companies who want to fly satellites. You have maybe sovereign customers who want to fly astronauts to the space station. And at the bottom line, it's the return on investment. Obviously, the more rapid the return, the better. But as you said, in the current economic climate, I think that's very unpredictable.
Here's your first email question for the day. And listeners, this is Sunday, so unless you don't have access to the phone or you're doing some work on a Sunday, use the phone. It's a lot more fun. 1-866-687-7223. So Ben is in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he sent in a note, and he said, I look forward to looking at your book, but my question is, SpaceX is involved in many different projects, from Grasshopper to Falcon Heavy to Dragon, Dragon Lab, all sorts of things. Do you think that they could possibly be spread too thin to accomplish any of their goals well? Should they drop out or put on delay some of these projects that they keep talking about? After all, Falcon 9 is not even yet commercially operational.
Well, you look at the evolution of the company since its inception 10 years ago, 11 years ago now. In response to the projects that keep on coming online, like you mentioned, the Grasshopper,
right,
they've employed more and more people. I think they have close to 2,000 people now. It's a big, big company. I mean, they can deal with this. And they do have a lot of interest and a lot of development going along with the Dragon, Man Raising the Dragon, also the Falcon 9, and then the Heavy and the Super Heavy and the Grasshopper. But, I mean, they have the manpower to do it, and they have the experience. And also, but don't forget, they have the they have a lot of help from NASA as well, because as part of the commercial crew development and commercial crew integrated capability program, so they can draw on a lot of NASA expertise there. So I really don't think they're stretching themselves too thin.
So you don't think they're spread too thin?
No.
Okay. I've heard that from other people as well. Here's another question to ask you, and this is Sandra, and Sandra is in Dallas, Texas, and she said, many of us find it amazing but troublesome that SpaceX always slips on its timeline and does not meet timelines for flights. Everything is always delayed. Do you have a sense of why that happens, and do you have a sense of when that will turn around? I think one of the hallmarks of something that is commercially successful is that their schedule is dependable on a commercial basis.
Yeah, they have to have, they have the manifest. And when you look at the delays, you know, there were lots of delays initially when they were developing the Falcon. I mean, that's understandable because they were starting from scratch. But I mean, the delays that they had with the resupply missions to ISS, and we're not talking big delays. We're talking in the order of a few weeks, really, for those. And when you compare that to government, take a look at the government manifest of the satellites that are being launched on the Atlas V and the Delta vehicles, and you'll see plenty of delays there. We're talking about a commercial operation here, and they don't have the benefit of government funding, government subsidy. So I think that's to be expected, that you will get delays, whether it's whether it's commercial or government. And I don't think that reflects badly on SpaceX.
What stands out in your mind as the most winning or successful or impressive thing about SpaceX? If you were to list, say, the top two or three most impressive successes about SpaceX, what would they be from your perspective?
I'll probably go along with the combination of the resupply missions. So if you remember when they had the first resupply mission, it was actually slated for two separate missions, but because of the COTS demonstration mission. So I think it was CS-1 and CS-2.
Uh-huh.
And they combined those two missions because they were able to demonstrate to NASA that they were so good at what they were doing that they could actually combine those two missions in one. I think that was a big achievement. I think also the timeline, you're looking at 10 years. I mean, from nothing in 2002... to delivering cargo to the International Space Station and re-entering. I mean, that's a challenge. People don't understand the re-entry problem. But, I mean, to be able to do that and to actually bring back cargo from the ISS and get it to splashdown, so to go from zero to that in 10 years is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, you look at other governments who've done that, and they've taken a lot longer and spent, by orders of magnitude, much more than SpaceX spent to do that. So I think the combination of the resupply missions, the time that it took them to get there, 10 years, just absolutely extraordinary to do that.
Could they have been doing this? Would they have this success were it not for the NASA funding that has supported them, as well as the NASA collaboration, because there is substantial collaboration from NASA, correct?
There is. There's an awful lot. As I said, the long pole in the tent really is the funding. So hats off to NASA for doing that. Because without NASA, then you probably wouldn't have the situation we're in now with commercial spaceflight. Like I said, that number, 80% to 90%, and that's across all companies, not just SpaceX,
not right.
Boeing, Sierra Nevada, Blue Origin. They all get similar funding.
So many people say, because of this government funding, to call these companies commercial space is bogus. It's just a different way of government contracting. So how do you reply to that comment? You probably have heard it before, too.
Well, if you look at the way NASA operates, it has all these centers dotted across the country.
Right.
And it's very political, because they want to obviously try and have so much business in one state and so much business in another state. And because of that, you have all these layers of bureaucracy, all these layers of administration, and things take longer to get done. And by handing money over to commercial spaceflight companies such as SpaceX or Sierra Nevada, you cut through a lot of those layers of administration, and you say, "Here's the money. This is what we need to get done. Get it done." And that's what SpaceX have done. So they're really the advantage of having commercial spaceflight companies like SpaceX is that you cut through all those layers of bureaucracy and administration that you traditionally had with government entities like NASA.
And then, you don't think it alters the definition of commercial then?
No, I don't think so, because they can draw on the expertise of NASA. They can, but at the end of the day, it's SpaceX who are doing that are doing most of the workload, most of the development, most of the testing, and most of the flight.
Here's another one. Todd, he always does the email from San Diego. And Todd says, "Hi, David. I see you're now in last place, not the Padres." Well, Todd, this is not going to be a baseball show now. But we appreciate your sentiments. Todd says the following. Many people think that SpaceX could have actually had astronauts in the Dragons that they have flown so far, and would have easily returned to Earth or the ocean, so to speak, totally safe without any problems whatsoever, given the way that the Dragon performed. Is there anything in your research that would counter that? We know that they're not human-rated yet, and that could not have happened, but do you think that right now astronauts could fly in a Dragon and they would be totally safe?
Yes, I do. And if you remember the first resupply mission.
Right.
One of the people watching the return was Robert Bigelow, and he was quoted across a lot of, quoted on lots of websites, saying that what we've just seen is, pretty close to perfect mission, and if astronauts had been on there, they would have survived, and everything would have been okay. And Robert Bigelow has interest in SpaceX. I think he has an MOU with them, or some sort of agreement with them, because he's looking to use the man-rated Dragon to take his sovereign astronauts to his habitat, which is going to be flying on ISS next year to be tested, and then they're going to have the inflatables, I think, up in 2015, 2016. So, you look at the flight profile, you look at the G-loading, everything about that flight, if there's been astronauts in it, they would have survived. I mean, they can lose one parachute on the re-entry and still have a safe landing.
And still have a safe landing, yeah.
Very, very safe system, very robust system that they have. But obviously they have to go through the man rating development to get all the checks in the boxes, because this is partly a NASA endeavor, because at the end of the day, it's going to be NASA that are going to be putting their astronauts in Dragon.
The Dragon has just performed incredibly, and boy, the accuracy upon landing is pretty amazing, isn't it? You do have a caller, Eric. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you from, please?
Oh, this is John in Fort Worth.
Hi there, John. I hear the cowbells are ringing.
Yeah, I even saw some cattle this morning. Saw a donkey the other day, too.
A donkey?
I saw them in my house.
Go for it with Eric.
Yeah. On the Falcon 9, which I think is their, most commercially available product, how long do we think will be before we'll start actually seeing commercial flights outside of the COTS program? I mean, in terms of just general commercial satellite launches.
When will we see what? I didn't quite catch the end of that.
Well, when will Falcon, actual company, launch their satellite with a Falcon 9 as opposed, we have the COTS program, but that's NASA funded and very NASA program. But just somebody that wants to launch a satellite, when do we think that some of that manifest will really actually be flown?
Well, I think the first flight is the Falcon V1.1 is due to fly the NASA's Deep Space Climate Observatory in November 2014. So I think 2014 that's supposed to be the first Falcon 9 flight with a satellite. And one of the problems they're having right now is fitting the new tanks because the Falcon 9 has a more powerful engine. So we're talking about the difference now between the Falcon 9 Block 1 and the Falcon 9 V1. Is that what you're asking about? Is the Block 1 or the upgrade to the Falcon 9?
Well, either one. I'm just saying that where somebody, comes in and contracts them to launch a satellite that isn't a NASA program. The basic COTS program, we know those are launches that are already, going to happen, right? But they're funded. But other people utilizing it, because their whole success seems to me to pivot on being able to actually get this commercial business in and actually start making flights and successfully, right? If they can do that, they will become a successful company in every way, shape, and form, I would assume.
Yeah, and that's the problem is the money, is the business. So right now they have, I think, 27 flights manifested for the Falcon 9, and they could probably most likely see more depending on the development of the other competitors, such as Antares, which is the orbital sciences vehicle. That's supposed to be ready to go soon. And then also looking at more complex missions as well, because they're not only developing the Falcon 9 upgrade to the Block 1, they're also developing the Falcon Heavy, because the Falcon Heavy is supposed to be used in the Space Test Program satellite. So that's supposed to be happening in September 2015. So they've got a lot of things they're working on, and they have a lot of flights on the manifest, so I think you will be seeing the Falcon 9 Block 1 and the Falcon Heavy being used on a pretty regular basis. Maybe not so much for commercial, but especially for Pentagon satellites and national security payloads.
They have on their manifest, they have a lot of commercial flights with AsiaSat, Orbcomm, and others at the end of this year and then going on into next year, and they have these Iridium flights coming up too. So there are commercial flights that are listed on their manifest as to whether, they actually take off and fly when they say they're going to do. They don't have a date like July 2014 or anything like that. They just say like Orbcomm 2014, Falcon 9, Cape Canaveral, for example. But the commercial missions are scattered in, and you can see them on their manifest. I don't know for a fact, but I assume they have paperwork supporting some sort of confirmation or contractual obligation for that mission, notwithstanding, that you can slip schedules or something like that, whatever goes into the deal. But the commercial missions are there. People can go and look on their manifest and see them.
I think one of the questions that some people have is whether a combination of government and commercial work will be enough to support multiple launch providers, because right now we're just looking at really SpaceX and ULA. ULA, they have a lot of flights on their manifest. They have, I think, the Air Force is preparing to negotiate to buy up to 50 ULA cores, so 50 vehicles over the next 5 years. That's just ULA. And then you have Antares coming along, and you have SpaceX. So I think the question will be over the next few years, not so much whether SpaceX can fly out its manifest, but whether there's enough work out there if you have all these launch providers. Because you might have, in 4 or 5 years, you might have half a dozen launch providers, and then you might see SpaceX trying to compete for work with ULA and some of the other companies.
Well, yeah, and they're also going to be competing against Ariane and the Russian launchers and possibly some of the Indian and Chinese launchers. So there's a lot of options out there depending on the origin of the cargo and what it is and what its mission is. And SpaceX has a pretty good road to haul to get into the game and to stay there. And to I think they've got a lot to prove still, and we'll see. But the more success they have with the commercial manifest, the faster they're going to rise up to being one of the top-notch competitors.
Yeah, and if they have a lot of successful flights, then they will start taking some of the competition away from ULA. So, for example, ULA, for the people who don't know, that's the United Launch Alliance. So that's a monopoly, really, that started in 2006 as a result of Lockheed Martin and Boeing operating the Pentagon's Atlas V and Delta IV rockets. And what's happening now is that the Pentagon's looking at SpaceX to try and fly some of its satellites. So its Class A satellites, these are national security payloads that aren't risk tolerant, which means what they want SpaceX to do is to achieve three flights with a payload fairing. And these have to be flown consecutively. Once SpaceX achieves that, then the Pentagon will come along and say, okay, we're ready to give you some business, and you're going to see a lot more flights on SpaceX's manifest.
John, what else do you have in mind?
Well, okay. Well, how many Falcon 9s have actually been completed to date in terms of production? I mean, where are we? Are we four or five? Where are we at now? I mean,
I don't know that. Maybe Eric does.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, do they actually have the launchers ready to go if somebody makes a contract, or are they pretty much building one for each mission? That's kind of where I'm.
Well, all I can. I don't know the answer, but maybe someone out there does. But each time I have been to SpaceX in Hawthorne, here's kind of what I see. There's a Falcon 9 in the back, all laid out, being shrink-wrapped or protected or something, ready to go down to Texas for the next level of testing. And there's one to two in the manufacturing line. And with the Dragon, every time I've been down there, I think there's been at least one Dragon that is completed or nearly completed, and then again one to two going through the process of being made into a Dragon. I've not ever seen the raw metal being stamped or shaped or created. So everything that I've seen is recognizable as the Falcon 9. Or the Dragon, but there's always been one that's ready to go to Texas for testing, and there's always been one to two on the line, so to speak, in process. So Ariane, I mean, they haven't been on the show for about 2 years, but they attributed their commercial success part of it. They're certainly not cheap, so I don't know that they're going to attribute pricing to this, but they will produce 35 Ariane's at a time in order to mass produce and hold down their cost as much as possible, although they've never ever made a profit for the governments that are participating in it, even though it's the most successful commercial rocket in the world. But they're producing 35, and when I've had George Sowers on from ULA, I've asked him if ULA does that, and they do not. So I don't know what the ready-to-go inventory is for ULA, but I know Ariane seems to really pride themselves in doing that, and everybody else at best might have one or two ready to go, and I think that's probably how they plan their inventory and their manufacturing.
Yeah. ULA's plans to launch 12 this year.
What is it again, Eric?
Well, ULA has 12 launches this year and 14 next year.
I mean, so, you know, that's one a month, basically. Yeah. And does that include Delta and Atlas or just Atlas?
Oh, I couldn't tell you.
What else, John? I'm sorry we interrupted you.
Well, one of the concerns I've had about SpaceX, which is one of its big claims of fame, is the best cost out there, that they're the cheapest. And I'm wondering how scalable that will be once they let's assume they really are running flying 10 flights a year and things like that, and as they have to ramp up, and as the company ages, basically, can they actually maintain that level of cost, or are they going to actually grow in cost, kind of almost inverse learning curve, if you will, because of having to hire people in, of the training, just the economy of scale, that once it gets bigger and bigger and the boss doesn't literally know everybody anymore, things get more and more inefficient, like any corporation does. I mean, every bloated aerospace company today was at one time a lean, mean airplane building machine that had one brilliant leader that had a small company, and you know, like in the 30s or something, but you know, things evolve, and I'm just wondering if they can maintain it.
So people talk about there being absorbed like the Borg all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that's kind of what you're talking about.
Further, they get involved with customers that have all kind of requirements, and you know, then some people show up they're not used to dealing with. With their own social requirements, and you know what I mean.
Well, Elon is aware of all of this. I've heard him talk about these issues before. So, whether I think they like every company would thread a careful line, and you know, hopefully they don't get absorbed. But Eric, what did you find out in your research for the book?
In terms of what's going to happen in the future?
Yeah, what do you think is going to happen? Are they going to get absorbed into the system? Or,
no, I don't think so. I don't think that's what Elon Musk is about. I mean, this is point of interest. The ULA, they're actually reducing the workforce by 2,000 people to improve efficiency. Seeing we're talking about efficiency here, so they had a merger back in 2006, and they had 3,700 people back then. And now they're actually handing out notices to 2,000 of their workforce to actually improve efficiency. But I don't think you're going to see that in SpaceX. It's, ULA has a very narrow business in terms of what they do, whereas SpaceX is pretty diverse in what they do. They have the unmanned launch business with the Falcon 9 and the Heavy and the Super Heavy. They have the Dragon, the Dragon Rider, the Dragon Lab, the Grasshopper. I mean, they have a lot of things that they're doing. And they're doing them very well. And it's always difficult to see what's going to happen, you know, 5 years down the line. But I think because of the diverse projects that they have, I think that will see them in good stead.
Hmm. Well, last thing. When's the Falcon Heavy supposed to have its first flight? When will that?
Falcon Heavy was 2015, I think, according to...
Well, it's on the manifest for next year. Yes, it is. Falcon Heavy 2014. Falcon Heavy demo flight, Vandenberg. Again, it doesn't provide dates or anything, but just for those that are bean counters out there with a green visor on them, the Falcon Heavy demo flight 2014, Vandenberg, is the first flight listed for 2014. The one right before it is Orbcomm 2013 Falcon 9 Cape Canaveral. So this is the first listing for the manifest for 2014 Falcon Heavy demo flight.
Vandenberg. The first Pentagon flight I had with a Falcon Heavy was September 2015.
Well, all I'm doing is reading their manifest on air. I have no inside information or anything. I don't know if they keep the manifest current or if they need to update it. I mean, all of that is beyond my pay grade. So I'm just telling you what's on the manifest. I've got it right in front of me on my laptop. So maybe someone who has an updated schedule, if one exists, can let us know what's happening. But there it is. If you pull up manifest on the SpaceX website, spacex.com/launch-manifest, and you will get the same thing I get. Maybe. I don't even know about that. maybe computers are different. They're also crazy. So 2014 is what it says, but I really, that's 5 months from now or so. I just don't see that happening.
Like, that will probably slip. to something what Eric is saying. Yeah, well, that's I believe that's also going to have a, I don't know if anybody's ever done what they're claiming to have done, going to do with this, is to basically use the two side boosters as tankers. I don't think the Delta IV really heavy really does that. It just uses them, I think, as boosters, I believe. Well, they're going to actually pump fuel out of those into the center rocket.
Yeah, they have an interesting fuel feeding system for the Falcon Heavy. We'll see how that works.
That'll be a step ahead if they pull that off. I mean, I'm looking forward to that. Bob, people call in, but I wish them the best. I'm not being negative. I'm just kind of doing my thing, you know.
Thank you. His book is great. You ought to take a look at it, and I think you'd find it very, very interesting.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, John.
Bye.
Yeah, thanks.
Listeners, our line is opened up at 1-866-687-7223. Eric, we're at the halfway point, so I think we'll take our pause here, and we'll be back, everybody, in 3 minutes. And more with Dr. Seathouse and his book, again, the title, SpaceX, Making Commercial Spaceflight Reality. One of the things I'll ask you when we get back are there's still people in Congress that don't seem to really want to see commercial spaceflight sort of replace the traditional way we've done things. I'm going to ask you for your thoughts on that position in Congress, if it's something to be concerned about, if you're the phone's ringing again. Let's take the call, and then we'll do the break, okay?
Yep.
Hi, listener. You're on the show. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Okay, so I'm taking you before we go to the break.
Okay.
You're on with Eric in Canada.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, Eric, good to talk with you again.
Hey, thanks for the call.
Yeah.
So go for it, Doug. We're waiting to hear your wisdom.
I'm not on the air, right?
Yeah, you are on the air.
Oh, okay.
We're waiting. We're waiting. Come on. If you pause like this on a cardiac patient, you'd lose your patient.
I'm sorry. I thought we were still on the break.
Yeah, I can see you telling that to the court in the liability suit.
I'd be in trouble.
That's right. Get with it, man.
Okay. Eric, my thinking is that the Falcon 9 is, in terms of capability, like kilograms to, or, you know, tons to Leo, is comparable to what, Atlas or certain Atlas or Delta rockets are. But it seems to me as though the Falcon Heavy is really in a new category, because with the cross speed, they might be able to get as much as 5 times the upmass compared with the Falcon 9. So how significant do you think if the Falcon Heavy flies and is successful and it can put up to 53 tons to low Earth orbit, how much of an impact do you think that capability will have for America's space program?
Well, I think it's huge. So let's just run through a few numbers here. So, as you said, the Delta IV Heavy is comparable to the Falcon Heavy. So we know that. It even looks similar to the Falcon Heavy, but its performance is much, much higher. So that means the cost of launch is much lower. How much lower? So we know the Falcon Heavy, that can put 53 metric tons into orbit compared to the Delta IV Heavy. Heavy's 23 metric tons. That's a 230% improvement. 230%. So from a customer's perspective, who are you going to go for? Are you going to go for the Delta IV Heavy or the Falcon Heavy? But you're going to go, let's look at the launch cost. So bear in mind that the Falcon Heavy has a 230% improvement in terms of how many metric tons it can put into orbit. But the Falcon Heavy costs only about $100 million per launch, whereas the Delta IV Heavy costs $435 million per launch. That's based on an Air Force contract. So when it comes to calculating payload costs, when you look at the Delta IV Heavy with its 23 metric ton low Earth orbit capability, you're looking at about $19 million per ton, or about $8,500 per pound, compared to the Falcon Heavy's price of about $850 per pound, or $1.9 million per ton. That's one-tenth of the price of a Delta IV Heavy. That's just a night and day difference. So if you're a customer and you want to send a payload into space which weighs, you know, 45, 50 tons, it's just a no-brainer. I mean, that's why SpaceX is so important in the industry, because it's just driven down costs, and it hasn't driven down costs by small amounts. It's driven them down by an order of magnitude. I mean, it's just amazing, absolutely amazing.
Well, Eric, it seems to me as though if the launchers that are available right now are sized down in the, you know, I don't know, 15 tons of LEO range, then it seems like the satellite manufacturers would be in the habit of producing the satellites in that size. And so might Falcon Heavy show up, and yet there's, you know, sort of more rocket than what's needed.
Sorry, can you say that again? The line isn't too good.
I'm sorry. Satellite manufacturers are used to producing satellites the size of the existing launchers. So if the Falcon Heavy shows up, can lift considerably more mass to LEO, is it simply more rocket than what the market is demanding?
Well, not if you look at the manifest. I mean, they have a pretty healthy manifest. I think the last time I checked, they had 40 payloads divided between the Falcon 9 and the Falcon Heavy. And that number far exceeds any number, any government contract. And it's still adding flights every month. So, and the reason for that, or part of the reason for that, is because you have SpaceX is in a niche right now. There aren't many competitors, not many commercial competitors who are competing against SpaceX because they don't have vehicles up and running. I mean, you're still looking at the Delta IV Heavy, which is very expensive. You're still looking at other vehicles out there which just can't compete in cost. I mean, once a few more commercial vehicles come on stream, then you may see that manifest become more competitive. But right now, the reason SpaceX has such a healthy manifest is, first of all, because of those ridiculously low launch costs, and secondly, because there just isn't much competition.
Now, Eric, I mean, it seems to me when I look at Falcon SpaceX's manifest, it shows a demand for Falcon 9, but it's not clear to me that their manifest is showing a demand for Falcon Heavy. So I'm going to repeat my question. Might Falcon Heavy be more rocket than what the market is demanding?
I think part of the reason is because it hasn't flown yet. Maybe people are waiting to see how the first test flight goes and how the first flight with the Pentagon payload goes in September 2015. And then once it's a flight-proven system, then I think you may see more launches on the Falcon Heavy manifest. But
as
to whether they've put themselves in a tight corner because of the actual size of the payload, it's difficult to say.
But, you know, a couple of things. I wouldn't be true to form unless I jumped in here with a little reality check. He has said that he needs at least 4 flights a year for Falcon Heavy to be commercially operational and successful. So that's a very different number than for Falcon 9. And then in terms of all the numbers that you listed, Eric, first of all, this is a mythical rocket. It does not yet exist. It has never flown. It is not made. It has not been tested. So all of the data about it, from pricing to performance specs to everything, while they might be based on really great, experienced, and wonderful assumptions, they're not real. And they're not going to be real until this rocket actually shows up and starts working and SpaceX actually sees what it does and how it operates and what they have to do to operate it and correct the bugs and fix all the fixes and all of that. Now, furthermore, I have interviewed for years the people who both launch cargoes on Deltas and Arians and Atlases and all of those companies. And the cost of the launch is not their driving factor. Their driving factor, 100% of the time, for every one of them on a commercial mission, is dependability, scheduling, and being able to be routine. And SpaceX, even with their Falcon 9, cannot produce yet routine and dependable scheduling. They've been dependable in the sense that you're not going to lose a rocket. So far that's been pretty damn good, except for the secondary payload for Orbcomm that one time. But they all say that losing the rocket and not being able to launch on time is far more important than what it costs for the launch, because their revenue streams from their products are so huge and so powerful that if they face time delays on those revenue streams starting, or if they dump one of them in the ocean, that's really a killer, whereas $400 million for the launch is not a killer. So SpaceX can cut the price, but if they don't have pretty dependable scheduling and launch dates and able to keep to that, and if they're not turning out to be routine, they're not going to get the bulk of the business.
Oh, good point.
And so far, in my opinion, and I'm the furthest thing from an engineer in the world, you know, I'm a business guy, but their biggest hurdles are going to be becoming routine and dependable with their scheduling. It's just like, you know, if you want to take a plane to New York, I mean, my flight leaves at 8:30 a.m. tomorrow morning, so you don't want to find out that, oops, that flight's canceled. It's going to leave at, you know, noon on December 1st instead. We got to do some work on it. I mean, who in the hell would support that? So they really need to get tight with their scheduling and their routine operations. That's really key for commercial flight.
Yeah, I agree.
David, I would just like to jump in your ear.
Yeah, I know. You don't agree with me because you think the damn thing's already real. I know that. But
well, Falcon Heavy is based on Falcon 9, and Falcon 9 is real. So,
but one doesn't mean the other. Come on.
You know, the same engines, the same fairings.
I'm sorry, they're different. This is going to be really interesting, Doug, and then we'll ask Eric about this. The next Falcon 9 launch is really a different rocket. It's one of the things I want to ask you about, Eric. It's 30 feet longer. It has different controls. They've been routed and placed differently. The engines are different. So, you know, we're really going to see a different generation of Falcon 9. It is not the same rocket that has been launched before. So, yeah, the components are all there and everything. But, God, you change things around. I mean, that it changes so many variables and equations and issues with how the rocket's going to perform and everything else, that it's not the same. And you can't just extrapolate the new Falcon 9 and say, okay, we're going to put 27 of them together now, and we got the Falcon Heavy, and wow, everything works, so it should work perfectly. Well, maybe it will. Maybe their engineering will be that great, and I sure as hell hope it does. But come on, this thing hasn't even been made yet, and it hasn't been tested yet, and it hasn't even flown a maiden flight. So you're jumping the gun, Doug, but I know I'm not going to convince you. So, you know, but that's why I'll continue to tease you. But we'll see what happens. I hope you're right, and I turn out to be... Well, I'm not predicting failure. I'm just saying there's a big road to go to becoming real.
I feel like SpaceX is still fairly new, and I think as they get experience in the development, I mean, they're growing their organizational capacity and their processes.
Yeah, all that's true.
So
yeah, they're evolving, and they're doing a damn good job of it.
But, Eric, let me ask you this question again, and that is not so much how would Falcon Heavy impact the commercial satellite launch market, but how would it impact America's national programs, such as sending crew in the future to, you know, the Orion capsule, for example, supporting an EML-2 mission potentially.
So you're talking human spaceflight, right, Doug?
Of course, that's in the future. But when you have 53 metric tons of LEO, you know, it raises some interesting possibilities. And I'd just like to ask Eric what he thinks might be possible as a result of that capability.
Well, first of all, they're on track to man rate it by 2015, and maybe have the first launch with a crew in 2016. So that really helps the government. Also helps NASA, because the space launch system with the Orion isn't going to be ready until 2017. That's an optimistic date. So it saves them a lot of money, because right now I think the cost of a Soyuz flight per seat is around $70-72 million. So when you're flying astronauts up to the ISS, three at a time, that's $200 million per flight. So SpaceX, I think the seat cost was down to about $20 million. So you multiply that out by the number of crew members going up to ISS every year.
Three for the price of one.
Yeah, so you're saving a lot of money.
Although it holds seven.
That's obviously a big impact there. And as we know, with these launch systems, the space launch system or the Senate launch system, whatever you want to call it, that may slip. Just like the SpaceX man rating may slip. But all the signs are looking good for a 2015 launch. And like I say, that buys them two years, which they otherwise wouldn't have had if they were waiting for the space launch system to come on stream.
Eric, do you expect to be present when the Falcon Heavy attempts to launch the first time?
Say again?
Do you expect to be present when they attempt the first Falcon Heavy launch?
Do I expect to be present?
Do you want to go view the launch?
Oh, no. I wouldn't be able to make it.
So Doug, if it really does launch in next year with a demo flight at Vandenberg, you and I are going.
You bet.
I don't know how we'll pull it off, because I don't want to park outside of Vandenberg and see it. I actually want to get on the base.
Well,
so,
I'd love to get in, but I'm not a journalist.
No, but maybe I'll appoint you as my gopher for my equipment. And say I need you to be my, what do they call the safari guys, who carry all the equipment and everything?
Ripped, is it?
No, that's in the movie industry. No, the guys that carry all your stuff when you're going on a safari, from the 1800s or the 1900s, they had a name for the carry guys. But anyway, that's what I'll put that down on the application.
I appreciate it. I'll be there.
Anything else, Doug?
Nope, that's about it.
All right. Thank you.
Okay,
and listeners, we are taking a break. We're way beyond halfway. And we'll be back with Dr. Seedhouse and more about this fascinating industry, SpaceX, and some of the others. I really, Eric, am a big, big fan of Sierra Nevada and Dream Chaser. And I'll ask you about this, but one of the things that puzzles me is how you're ever going to have an economic launch on an Atlas V. I don't care if it's the most basic Atlas V there is. That thing is just not economic. But let's talk about it when we get back. Stay put, everybody. Back with Eric in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody. This is the part two of our Sunday program. Our guest today, Dr. Eric Seedhouse, his book, SpaceX, Making Commercial Spaceflight a Reality, is sort of loosely what we're talking about. Before the break, Eric, I wanted to know your thoughts on Dream Chaser. I mean, I'm a big, big fan of the company and Dream Chaser, but I do have trouble grasping being commercially, economically priced on top of an Atlas vehicle.
Yeah, if I had to choose to fly into space in any vehicle, it would be in the Dream Chaser. I mean, it's just a beautiful vehicle, and the reason I love it so much is because of the legacy behind its design. So it's modeled on the HL-20 lifting body, the X-34. So it has a tremendous amount of development history in it, and I think that's why it will succeed technically. Whether it succeeds commercially is another question. But Sierra Nevada Space Systems, they're a very, very, very successful company. They've had more than 400 successful space missions. They've delivered more than 4,000 systems, subsystems, and components. And they've completed more than 70 programs with NASA. They've put a lot of effort into this space plane. It's very capable. It's going to carry, or it will carry, 7 crew up to ISS. And the downside, as you said, it's designed to launch vertically on a man-rated Atlas V. And Atlas V's don't come cheap, but it's an elegant design. As I said, the legacy is there in terms of design and development. And it's a very close, almost identical mission architecture to the space shuttle. So it's on the pointy end of an Atlas V, rather than having solid rocket boosters next to it. But it goes up into low Earth orbit, docks with the ISS, and then it returns to Earth by gliding, just like the space shuttle. So it's a very elegant system. It's got a launch escape system. It's got a hybrid motor. It's got pilot return to landing site maneuvers. It's got a very easy G-loading on the crew. I think the crew is only subjected to 2G. And like I say, it's a very versatile system. And for me, I just hope they get to launch it.
Right, and in keeping with what I said in the first segment, Atlas V is a very, very reliable, dependable, and routine vehicle. So, again, you look at the mission and who you're flying the mission, and it may be more important to pay extra to launch on an Atlas V with the Dream Chaser because of the dependability and routineness and all of that than it would be to fly on a vehicle with a very expensive payload that does not have that track record that Atlas V has, and it does have an amazing track record. It's a really good rocket. So
yeah, and if you look at the history of Sierra Nevada, the way the funding works with these companies, that they're given money by NASA, and then they are given a series of milestones, and if they meet those milestones, then they're given more money. And so Sierra Nevada, they're in the process now of meeting a series of milestones. If they meet those, then they're going to get a few more million dollars from NASA. Continue the development. So right now they're at the stage where they're looking at integrated system safety design and looking at how the system meets the design reference mission, looking at wind tunnel testing, and then they're looking at the main propulsion and the reaction control system risk reduction. So they're moving ahead and they're meeting the milestones. And like I say, everything is looking good technically. Everything's looking good from a development perspective. At the end of the day, it's whether it's commercially viable. But I really would like to see them fly.
Eric, we have two Mars missions on the drawing board. So one is Dennis Tito's Inspiration Mars 2018, and then we've got the Mars 1 covered wagon express to settle the West going out there around 2021. You know, there's been some talk that SLS might be used for Tito's mission, although I don't think it's supposed to be operational by then, but who knows. Do you have any information on how Falcon Heavy might fit into Mars One or Inspirational Mars? Or I mean, I can imagine it's all speculation. Hell, Mars One is speculation. But what are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, if you know anything about the history of SpaceX, then you know that Elon Musk He doesn't want to stop in low Earth orbit.
No, he's a Mars guy all the way.
He's a Mars guy,
yeah.
Through and through. That's what he wants to do. That's his major goal, is to actually land on Mars using the rockets and capsules that he has. And I think in his mission architecture, they would be looking at using a Falcon 9 Heavy, because this can put 50-odd tons into low Earth orbit. And from there, they would use the Dragon variant, which is called the Red Dragon. So they'd ferry instruments to the surface of Mars first, land a few of those Red Dragons with the ISRU and various other bits and pieces that you need for a Mars mission. And then once that's all in place, then you'd send the crew. So when that's going to happen, we don't know, because we still have to solve the entry, descent, and landing problem. And I think that's a big showstopper right now. I think we obviously talk about radiation and bone demineralization and everything else, but that's all well and good. But if you can't actually land safely on Mars, then you haven't got a mission. And right now, the long pole in the tent is the EDL, and they still have some way to go to solve that. So,
well, I think financing is their long pole in the tent. They got to raise $6 to $8 billion. I'm not a big believer in the Mars One business model, so. Well, I don't think they'll raise the money.
I think SpaceX probably has a better chance of succeeding.
Oh, I would agree with. Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. But Mars One is marvelous at getting good press. And when they opened up their application process, about 80,000 people applied in just a very short period of time. So there's no shortage of people who want to do the one-way trip and settle on Mars, that's for sure. But I don't know that they're going to, you know, secure $6 to $8 billion to pull this off and to do it. I guess I may be surprised, but I'd be really skeptical that business model is going to work.
That's a long shot, but it might make for good TV.
I don't know. I mean, you want to watch people training to go on a Mars mission? I don't watch virtual shows, so I'm not the market for any of it. So. No, it wouldn't make good TV for me. But as I said, I don't watch Survivor or any of those programs. So do you think that SpaceX would be willing? I mean, you know, normally a commercial company sells to anybody, right? So the question I'm asking is if say one of these companies is a little flaky on their engineering or their system, do you think SpaceX would sell them a Falcon Heavy? I mean, if they kill their crew and screw up big time, it could really have a blowback on the company, even though they may not have had anything to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of media coverage about the fact that Mars One is planning on using SpaceX hardware, but there's no agreement. There's absolutely no agreement in place between SpaceX and Mars One. And I think if Mars One want to go ahead and buy a Falcon Heavy, which is about $130 million, then I really don't see why. I'm not sure whether SpaceX would stop them.
Well, only if they thought their mission was so whacked out and crazy that if they lost the crew or screwed up, the blowback would hurt the company.
Well, I'm not sure that it would, because it wouldn't be a failure of the Falcon hardware. It would just be a failure of the mission architecture.
Well, as you know, perception is reality, so it you don't know how it would get spun and what they would say. And, of course, we don't know why it would have failed in this hypothetical discussion. I don't know. I just raised the question, would they be cautious about selling to anybody, or would they just sell to anybody? And I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I honestly don't know.
Of course, in my opinion, I don't think these missions will ever launch, so I don't think it's going to be a big issue one way or another. What about now using Falcon Heavy to go to the moon for a lunar mission, I think, is much more plausible and very, very near term, probably as soon as they could be somewhat commercial. I think you might see some lunar missions evolving for Falcon Heavy. Any thoughts on that?
Well, again, going back to Bigelow Aerospace, which is another leader in the commercial spaceflight world, He has agreements in place with SpaceX because obviously he wants to use the vehicles and the Dragon to actually ferry crews up to his habitats. But just like Elon Musk, Big O doesn't want to stop in low Earth orbit. He actually wants to go to the moon and actually set up a commercial moon base. So that's where the application of the Falcon Heavy might come in, is that once Bigelow has a few of his habitats flying around in low Earth orbit and he's got a revenue stream coming in, then the next stage in his plan is to actually set up a commercial moon base. So I think that's when you might see a Falcon Heavy being used for a commercial moon mission.
Have you seen a Falcon launch from the Cape yet?
No. That's too expensive to keep on flying down to Florida, unfortunately.
Yeah, but it'd be really cool, to say the least.
Yeah, if when there's a manned mission, then the next manned mission, that's when I might go down.
Barbara is in Salt Lake City, Utah, and says, Eric, do you know if Falcon Heavy would be able to launch an Orion or the CST-100? Are all of these companies planning for multi-platforms, or are they geared up to just one rocket only?
Well, like I said, the Falcon Heavy, that can launch 53 tons into low Earth orbit. So the Orion, you wouldn't even need to use the Falcon Heavy. You could go with a smaller vehicle to actually launch.
Well, the question is, does it fit? Can they mate it to a Falcon Heavy?
Let's see, what's the width? The width is 5 meters, isn't it? I think.
I don't know.
I think that's the diameter of the Orion is 5 meters. So I have to check on my payload guide. So if you go into the payload guide for the Falcon Heavy and check on what the payload fairing is, I think you'd probably find that there's enough room in there for an Orion and with space to spare.
And what about the CST-100?
Again, it's a very similar size capsule. So the CST-100 is... I can't remember off the top of my head what the actual specifications are, but they're both designed to carry 7 crew members. They're both capsule design, and they're both approximately the same width, so about 5 meters wide.
You got a question from Dr. Doug again in Southern California, and he says, do you have any speculation on the Mars Colonial Transport? Hello?
Transport.
Yeah, do you even know what it is?
No. Okay. So just going back to the previous question, the actual payload width of the Falcon Heavy is 5.2 meters. So, yeah, it'd be a bit of a squeeze, but you could fit the Orion in.
Yeah. So, Doug, you're going to have to send a note in again or pick up the phone and call again and explain to the listeners and our guest what the Mars Colonial Transport is all about.
I haven't come across that.
And by the way, I haven't run across that either. So I don't know what you're talking about either, Doug. So call us back or email us in, please. Do you think that SpaceX is... I don't even know how you could answer this, but I'll throw it out there. Do you think SpaceX is going to stay in California, or do you think they might move?
No, I think they'll most likely stay in California.
Because I have heard, you know, talk where they might start moving more resources to Texas. But,
I guess once they start flying from the Cape, then on a more regular basis, they may shift some of the operations over to Florida. But honestly, I haven't read much about any plans to move. So honestly, I can't say.
Okay. Let's see who's calling. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you?
Hey, David. This is Doug again.
Okay. Mars Colonial Transport. What is it?
Okay. So we all understand that Elon has Mars on his brain. I mean, he has no other ultimate purpose except to, I guess, retire Mars, right?
Yeah, he has Martian DNA. Let's not kid ourselves.
Exactly. So He has indicated that he's going to be coming out with sort of description, sort of design plans for what he calls the MCT, and there was a lot of speculation about what the MCT was, and he confirmed that it was Mars Colonial Transport or Transporter. I forget which of the two.
Transport, cool, like Star Trek?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
I like this.
So basically, this would be a craft that would go from, I think, from low Earth orbit to the Martian surface. And, you know, he has visions of, you know, 70,000 people on, you know, going to Mars as sort of, you know, ultimately wants to send large numbers of people to Mars. And he has said, you know, people have speculated about it. I've seen some drawings of what people speculate what this might look like. He says that he's going to come out with the concept fairly soon. I forget when, but in my mind, it's in like in the next 6 to 12 months that he'll come out with probably a rendering of it. And he says it looks very spaceship-like. And my guess is that if it's unclear as to whether he still has the Falcon XX, which would be a heavy lift vehicle based on the Falcon technology, but it needed to develop a new large engine to be able to do that, or whether the Mars Colonial Transport would be launched on Falcon Heavy, which I think it would just be underpowered for that. So I don't know any details, but apparently it would be able to transport, I'm guessing, dozens or more people at a time to Mars.
What would they do on Mars, assuming they got there and could live there?
Well, yeah, it's a great question. I don't think there's much work. I don't know that people would, there's nothing to mine there. I mean, the economics wouldn't work for that. But people, I think Zubrin and maybe Musk have said that basically the people go there either to retire or to do the type of work that you could send the product back in bytes. Like, you know, engineers or whatever, producing stuff and broadcasting it back to Earth as their form of income.
Would you go there, Doug? Would you move to Mars?
No, I would not.
Eric, would you?
I'd consider it.
I wouldn't do it. not unless I could take a dog with me.
As long as they solve the entry, descent, landing problem.
you want to get there in one piece, right?
Yes, I prefer it.
Oh, this raises an interesting question that I'd really like to know, and that is, if you had enough propellant at like Phobos or Deimos, could you simply propulsively break down to the surface of Mars and solve all the EDL problems? Do you guys know?
I couldn't tell you that.
Say it again, Doug. What is the question?
If you have enough propellant already at Mars, and that is either you shipped it there from, you know, the Earth Moon system,
uh-huh,
or you're producing it on Phobos or Deimos, does that completely change the EDL problem, which I understand is a pretty significant problem for Mars?
How would it change it? How would you get that propellant to use as you're coming down?
Well, I think one of two ways. Either you transport it separately, so you launch, you know, say for example, on a upscaled SLS, 130 metric tons, for example, what you do is you could launch it and join it together with your man craft and take it with you, or you could ship it there and have it waiting in the system as your people arrive and they dock there, and then they have the necessary propellant to completely do propulsive braking, so that you're not trying to do, you're not depending so much on really large heat shields or a combination of parachutes and sort of sky crane type thing. Now, the other option would be to actually apply the ISRU production of at least oxygen, liquid oxygen propellant, or perhaps the full propellant, including fuel, on Phobos. You could apply lessons learned on the moon to Phobos and actually produce the propellant in situ, in which case you would first go to Phobos in a pretty small craft, and then orbit and then propulsively land on Mars. That's my understanding.
Well, if I get one of the propulsion people back on from JPL, this will be a time for you to ask them, because I don't know the answer to that. I suspect the issues would be much more complicated, but I don't know.
Yeah, all I know, they've completely rejected the sky crane approach because that works for anything up to about 1 ton, but anything larger than 1 ton, it's just too difficult. They've rejected the parachute decelerator, and so what they're looking at now is supersonic retropropulsion. And so SpaceX and NASA are actually working together to actually look at the EDL problem. And one of the things they're looking at is using the Super Draco engines, which is one of the engines that SpaceX is developing, to actually try and utilize supersonic retropropulsion to actually slow the vehicle as it enters the Martian atmosphere. So what they're doing, they're actually scaling it down. So they're looking at a vehicle that only weighs about 7 tons, which is doable. That's the key, I think, part of the key to solving the EDL problem is actually scaling down the vehicle. Right now, they're looking at habitats of 30 tons, 40 tons, and it's just too big. But if you scale it down just to the bare minimum, have a very small crew, and you're looking at maybe 6 or 7 ton vehicles, then it becomes doable. You're looking at supersonic retropropulsion being able to actually slow a vehicle that's 5 or 6 tons and slow that down sufficiently to actually land it safely on the surface.
Jeff Grayson, in his ISBC speech, fairly famous speech at Huntsville a couple years ago, I think, he said that if he proposed a sort of a called planet hopping strategy, where he produced propellant at each step, and he says that he said in his speech that if you produce enough propellant at Phobos, then you can using propulsion, you can get around the EDL problem for Mars. So he didn't give any details about it, but I'm just made me curious.
Okay, I'm gonna this afternoon start sending out some invites to my EDL JPL friends and see if they will come to another show. And let's see what they have to say about all of this. I don't know. I do know the next Mars mission that JPL is doing is using the same system that Curiosity used to get to the surface.
Right.
And that seems at least somewhat tried and somewhat proven. At least it worked one time, right?
Exactly.
So I don't know, but I think EDL to Mars, because of the variations in the atmosphere, is really a bitch. I don't know another way to say it, but again, I certainly will defer to all of those who know far more about engineering than I do.
The problem is too much gravity, not enough air,
and it varies throughout the course down. So it's not consistently thick or not thick, as is Earth's atmosphere. So you can go through pockets of thickness, and then it gets really thin, and then it'll get thick again here and there. So it's a very different kind of atmospheric problem than we have on Earth.
Yeah.
Those aliens land here with flying saucers all the time, so I don't know why we can't build a saucer to land on Mars.
Aren't we able to reverse engineer it?
I thought so, but that's the only secrets that are being kept. All the other secrets seem to be getting out and going freely all the way around the world, but we can't lock into those aliens, can we? Although your former defense minister over there in Canada has sure spoken out about it, Eric.
I missed that one.
I don't know how you could miss it. He's on the stump speaking about ETs and interacting with the Canadian military in the United States. Everywhere you go, I forget his name, but I forget his name. But boy, he's out there, more so than late night radio. All right, anything else, Doug?
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug.
What else should we know about your book? I mean, you cover so many things, and you got great pictures in your book, and you've got designs, like you've got this information on the CST-100 and Orion. What else would you like us to know about all of this? What have we missed talking about?
I'd like people to know that it's an upbeat book. I mean, it portrays SpaceX in a positive light all the way through, because I'm a fan of SpaceX. There's no politics or very little politics. It explains it from the ground up. So even if you're not a space fanatic, all the information is in this book, so that you understand the process of what is commercial space flight and how SpaceX were able to do what they did. There's information in there about the funding, about the SpaceX philosophy, and it explains how they do what they do by keeping things simple, keeping things low cost, and keeping things reliable, and also by getting rid of the layers of management internally and getting rid of the subcontractors externally. SpaceX can actually reduce the cost, and actually by doing that, they're actually just changing the face of commercial space flight. And like I say, it's just not launch vehicles that they're dealing with. This is a very dynamic company. They're looking at sending astronauts to the International Space Station, and they're actually developing engines or retropropulsion that can actually help us land on Mars. And like we just discussed, the end goal is, Elon Musk's end goal is actually to land people on Mars. So it's an exciting company, and just hope you go out and buy the book, and you can actually learn more about SpaceX.
Eric, this will probably be our last question, unless somebody wants to call in real quick. Jacob is in Tacoma, Washington, and he said, you mentioned this just before you went to break, David. I don't want you to forget about it. Eric, why do you think there is still resistance among some leading and powerful members of Congress, not so much to SpaceX, but to the entire commercial space flight effort to take over transportation to LEO from Earth? Why is there still resistance? It seems to me the model is working and is being proved that it is working.
Yeah, it is working, and the way the aerospace system, or the way the government space system works, is that it has lots of centers dotted around the country, and those senators represent those states in which those space centers are located, and obviously they want to make sure that those space centers thrive and make money, and the jobs are still there. And what they perceive as SpaceX doing is potentially taking business away from these centers, and so those space centers maybe don't do as well as they did before, and so they maybe perceive SpaceX as being a threat in that regard. And that's maybe why there's some resentment there, and why there aren't as many fans in the government as there might be.
But of course, that would indicate that they're not thinking, I don't even know why I'm going to say this, because Congress doesn't always act for what is good in the nation. They act for their own stupid, narrow interest and ideological agendas. But I was going to say, why would they sacrifice the good of the nation in terms of space for their parochial interest, in their region or their state or their country? But I guess I've already answered it. I mean, that's just what Congress is doing today, unless you have a better answer rather than my flip, sarcastic one.
Well, that's re-election, isn't it?
I guess you're about as flip and sarcastic as I am.
Well, yeah, just looking after their own interests and not for the greater good. So that's what it's all about at the end of the day, I think.
Well, we see eye to eye on that, my friend.
Like I said, I didn't put any of that politics in the book, because I wanted to try and stay clear of that. So all that you find in the book that is related to politics or Congress is just the government funding. So there's a clear explanation there of how the government funding works and how that is distributed to commercial spaceflight companies like SpaceX.
You got another question, if you can stay an extra few minutes. Jackie's in Boston, and I'm assuming Jackie is a lady. And so Jackie says, are there any other countries that are pursuing a commercial spaceflight program, including human space program, or is it really the United States that is doing it?
No, thank God for the United States. That's all I can say, because if it wasn't the United States, then chances are we wouldn't have this. We wouldn't have a commercial spaceflight program.
So
I mean, there are commercial spaceflight entities. I mean, little companies like Copenhagen Suborbitals and. There's a little company in Denmark trying to send one person to suborbit, but we're not talking about anything like the scale of SpaceX or Bigelow Aerospace or any of these companies. So, yes, there are little companies spotted around the world, but there's nothing on the scale that you have in the United States.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I also think there's pockets of entrepreneurism in some of the other countries, and there are entrepreneurial business incubators and things like that in various countries and on into Scandinavia and Northern Europe, but it's not even close to the scale of what goes on in the United States. So I think this is all a great plus for developing space, and I hope we start seeing commercial winners in the very near future. I really do think once some of these commercial operations start showing real profits from operations rather than from money from the government, I think the industry will really change rapidly. So one can hope. Any concluding comments, pearls of wisdom? Would you have another book you're working on already?
Yeah, it's called Suborbital. So that goes to the copy editor next week. And then I just got a contract to write about Bigelow Aerospace. So Bigelow Aerospace should come out next month. Oh, sorry, next year, what am I saying?
Is Bigelow going to work with you on that, or are you going to be a ghost again?
I'll probably be a ghost. I mean, I'll ask them. But, I know people who work at Bigelow Aerospace. And, again, it's probably the same with SpaceX.
They're tight with their PR.
It is, yeah, you can't blame them, really.
No, I as I said, it makes it harder for me, but I totally support the companies and what they're doing.
Although maybe what I'll do in this case is actually send them a copy of SpaceX and say, look, this is the sort of book I'm hoping to write about Bigelow Aerospace now. Will you grant me a couple of interviews?
Well, this will be great. So Suborbital might be out later this year?
It'll probably come out in October, November, yeah.
Well, let me know so we can talk about it again. I think we've done all of your books on the show.
Yeah, just about, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll look forward to some more. All right. Thank you very much. And listeners, you can pick it up on Amazon. And if you do that and you follow the instructions on Space Show and One Giant Leap websites, and it's really easy to do, you just enter with a special location on our site, and that takes you into the One Giant Leap nonprofit part of Amazon, and then you just put in your account information like normal and you just buy like normal, except that Amazon will give commissions and donations for everything that's purchased to One Giant Leap, or for that matter to other nonprofits that you do the same thing with. So that's one good way where buying the book is great for your knowledge about the industry, great for Eric, and terrific for the Space Show as well. So check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. And, Eric, I look forward to talking to you down the road when your next one comes out, okay?
I'm looking forward to it, David.
Thank you very much. Listeners, no show tomorrow. I am the designated driver for a friend who's getting sedated for various medical tests, so I'm off limits tomorrow. Open lines on Tuesday. Trent Waddington, our Australian listener and fan, is in the States. He came here all the way for the New Space Conference. And Trent is going to share with us the Australian perspective of what we're doing. Now, that's an entrepreneurial commercial country, but very, very tiny and does not have the resources of the United States. But I think you'll really enjoy hearing his view of a lot of different things. And then Sarah Howard, that first woman engineer in the Apollo program, has another cool, fun book to read about her experiences at Michaud during the Apollo period. And Sarah is back with us on Sunday. It's all in the newsletter. Check it out. And again, no show tomorrow. Thanks to Dr. Eric Seedhouse for all of your great work, Eric, and for being back on the show. And I look forward to seeing you around at some next space conference and also to talking to you when Suborbital comes out.
Yeah, looking forward to it, David. Thanks
okay.
again.
Listeners, thank you all for listening and participating. Goodbye from Eric, and goodbye from the Space Show.